I'm Hal Eisner, and this is What the Hal. You know, a lot of people, as they drive up and down streets, and this may or may not be the case in your town, I know it is in mine, you see one encampment after another, and it's only growing. Homelessness. And you wonder, what the hell can be done about it? Seriously, I mean, I'm not joking. I'm not trying to be flippant about it. I'm saying that, you know, when you drive onto freeways, and you drive off of freeways, and you go around the corners, there are people who are homeless. There are many policies, many bond measures, many ways that money is raised to try to help them. And so I've been trying to follow the money. I've been trying to follow how is that money being used? How long will it take to solve this problem? It is an ongoing issue. There is no question. But the goal here in Southern California, here in the Los Angeles area, by politicians, is to try to end homelessness in the next 10 years. It sounds like a really big undertaking, but what I can tell you from what I do see is that a lot of people have rolled up their sleeves to try to see what they can do to help these people that need help. Among those who are involved, the United Way of Greater Los Angeles and organizations who deal with permanent housing. You're about to meet executives and directors from those organizations. Elise Buick, President and CEO of the United Way of Greater Los Angeles. Veronica Lewis is Director of the SSG HOPEX, which is a homeless services provider that works in South L.A. Hi.
Hi.
Glad Hello. You're here.
Thank you.
Talk to me about the United Way. How long has the United Way been around?
Well, this is not a joke. United Way was founded back in 1899 by a rabbi, a priest, and a pastor who all came together in Denver to say, we can do more collectively together.
That really does sound like a joke.
It's
like
it's the truth.
Like you're supposed to follow that with, what the hell?
What the hell? Yeah.
Well, you know, they all came together. They wanted to do stuff for the community, and that's been the mission of the United Way forever, right? How many years?
Absolutely. So since the 1900s, you know, long time.
Over 100 years.
Yes.
And so, well, actually, it's over 100, let's say 118 years. Mm-hmm. Is that what we're looking at? Just 1900,
yeah.
Give or take? It's a long time. And so what did the United Way's goals begin as, and what do you think it's sort of morphed into?
Well, forever we were known as a fundraising organization. You probably remember the thermometers and the NFL ads, and that was really our contribution.
The thermometers being these big things that every time people made donations,
yep.
The red would go up the
it
thermometer,
would go up.
And the goal was way up here somewhere.
Right.
And you always wondered how long it was going to take for the red to get to the top and meet the goal.
But in this day and age, we have to do more than fundraise. Because people can give online, they can give in many different ways. So back about in 2007, 10 years ago, roughly, we said we have to have a greater impact in the community, and we focused on poverty. And that's what led us down a path of focusing on helping our homeless neighbors.
Homelessness is a problem across the country. It's not just unique to Los Angeles. But Los Angeles seems to be a city that has some of the biggest impact. And is that accurate? Is that the way to describe it, Veronica?
Yes, definitely. We have a concentration of people experiencing homelessness. People just think about Skid Row usually if they're not in LA, but we unfortunately have people living on the street, men, women, and children living on the street all across the city of Los Angeles. And so, yeah, it's a huge problem, and we're excited to be. We're 30 years old this year.
HOPEX has been around. I thought you were 21.
Well, I might be 21, but HOPEX is 30 years old. And, you know, actually our start was there was a homeless person. Our founder was homeless at the time, and he convinced the city and the county to fund a program that would allow very recently formerly homeless people to walk the streets of Skid Row, giving people information in the way they would receive it. And so we're glad to continue to carry that out, basically to meet people where they are, because you can't do homeless services in a cookie cutter capacity. The face of homelessness has changed. There's multiple types of folks, people that are working every day that are homeless. And so we're really excited about the new measures and the investment allowing us to be client-centered and do whatever it takes to help people get off the street.
So, you know, one of the things that we've seen recently, and it kind of comes in spurts, but we've seen violence. We've seen aggression. We've seen a man on Hollywood's Walk of Fame stabbed. We've seen a man at the Ventura Pier murdered. Right. These may be isolated, but because they're people who are homeless, it almost magnifies that homeless people especially those who might need mental health, become very aggressive and can be very dangerous. Would you take that thing I just said and kind of put it in some perspective?
Yes, I will. So I think, you know, the social ills and criminal activity and behavior touch a variety of communities, of course, including the homeless community. And certainly the face of homelessness looks very different and is very... And there are people, though, that have mental health conditions. There are people who have violent tendencies. And so, yeah, unfortunately, many of them have lost their housing. And so now they're living on the street. But I think it's really important for people to understand that while we recognize that and we're trying to provide street-based mental health services and taking services to the street as opposed to people having to walk through our doors, you know, that is really a small subset of the people experiencing homelessness. Many of the people experiencing homelessness found themselves unhoused because of an economic situation, because of a medical situation, because of a disagreement with family members. And so we do have to acknowledge it. And I think that's why the city and the county are really working closer with law enforcement. It's not just about homeless service providers. You have law enforcement involved, and you have other folks involved that can help mitigate those things. And they are real and they are concerns, and we do want people to be able to feel safe walking down the street, but that does not represent the homeless community at large.
Yeah, it may not, but you know, if you're walking down the street and there's a line of tents, you may very well walk across the street,
right,
opposite that, so you don't have to interact. You may fear public health issues,
right.
You may fear that somebody may jump out at you. The mere fact that there's fear,
right,
that's a public perception,
right,
maybe unfounded, maybe not. I mean, that's part of what I'm asking you is, how real is the fact that people, when you live on the street, decline mentally? I'm going to tell you a personal story. Many years ago, we had a mayor here in Los Angeles, Tom Bradley.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working at Channel 11 at the time. Tom Bradley wanted to do something special at Christmas. And so he put up a big tent on the lawn at City Hall, and he put cots in there, and he had food in there, and he had good cheer in there, and he wanted to give Christmas to the homeless. My assignment was to take my sleeping bag and go down and sleep on a cot and experience what they were experiencing. Now, I'm going to tell you, and I think I said it on television at the time, I couldn't make it through the night.
Right.
Really?
I could not. It was cold.
Right.
Remember, hypothermia between buildings can get really dangerous for people. It was so cold by about 3 in the morning, I had to go jump in the car, turn on the engine, warm up, and I stayed in there for a while before I went back and laid on the cot. I could not do it.
Wow.
I could not do it.
Right.
How do people do it? They do it because they have no choice. I had a choice. I had a car. I could go in and turn on the engine. So we lose people. They die. They get sick. And they are affected mentally.
Right. So, yes. And I think, you know, what's been happening, especially for the last 2 years, is that we've shifted. If you've paid attention, the word shelter is kind of going away. I know you're still using it, but we're shifting to a model of crisis and bridge housing that is a higher quality. It's 24 hours, so no longer are people lining up at the door to get into shelter. No longer are they having to vacate every morning and leave. And with that comes some very clear standards about temperature control, sanitation, clients to staff ratios. And so there's a tremendous amount of investment in this, but also the policies governing the work that's being done at those crisis housing facilities is also very important for people to understand that their dollars are going to quality facilities so that people can be safe and stably housed while they're working toward permanent housing. You know, and certainly there are a good fraction of folks that have mental health conditions, as I said earlier, and that's another part of the effort that Measure H is helping to pay for, to really attach those services and meet them where they are, so at the shelters or at the crisis housing facilities.
Measure H, of course, being a bond that was approved by the voters to raise. How much money was that? After a while, you just hear millions, and it sounds like every proposition is millions of this and millions of that.
$350 million a year for 10 years.
So you have these bridge buildings. They're either large tents or they're some kind of a structure that people can be inside of.
Right. Some of them are single-family homes as well.
But that's more of the permanent shelter.
No,
that's not really the bridge, is it?
No, a significant number of crisis housing providers are now doing it in single-family dwellings as well.
So I guess where I want to dive off of is that there's still, no matter how many beds you have in these places, not enough.
Right.
So the sidewalks become the beds. And we just keep seeing bigger and bigger numbers.
Right.
There's no, now, I, one would assume that once you put a shelter in 15 different council districts, and once you create more permanent housing and you do those sort of things, that we would see a decline of people from the sidewalk to these facilities. However, you cannot make somebody do something they don't want to do. And oftentimes what I hear from people who are homeless when I do these stories and I interview people is, I'd rather be here. Well, I'd rather be here on the sidewalk.
I think you are raising a couple of different issues. I mean, one, to Veronica's point, the face of homelessness has changed. So I know when we got into this work, you didn't see women and children that were homeless until the late 80s. And so the economic conditions really do change the status of what we're dealing with. We are having an affordable housing crunch right now. It is making more people homeless. They're having to sleep in their cars. But I think the one thing we have to be careful about is, you know, the people I've met, many of them have college degrees, veterans. They've had esteemed careers. I met Pamela early on, and she was a city councilwoman for West Hollywood. She worked at JPL, and she had a nervous breakdown. But we got her housed. And I think the big shift, and there's a couple things we need to remember. In the old days with shelters, you could not get housing unless you were clean and sober and had found God. And we put all these hoops in front of people. And I don't know if you've had anyone in your family, I have, who struggle with mental illness or alcoholism. It's not a short-term proposition. And so now we do housing first. And that is, we finally have realized that before you can treat mental health care issues, you have to get people housed. You know, they have to be in off the street. So I agree with you, Hal. There are people who don't want to go into a temporary solution, but most of the people I think that Veronica and her team works with, if you say, do you want a permanent home? They do want it, and they don't believe it's possible, and they can change their lives and turn it around. And that's what we like about this model. And the last thing I would say for your cynical listeners is that this model is actually 40% cheaper than leaving people on the streets. So not only is it compassionate, it's cheaper. And that's a myth we don't think about, is it does cost us to do nothing. And so if we get them housed, they're not cycling through the emergency rooms and our jail system. So to me, it's a great solution. I come at it from a compassionate of, I want people housed, but it's also cheaper. So,
well, I think compassion is a very important thing. And that's why anything that's done to help people,
yep,
is under that umbrella.
But if I may, I want to add one thing that I think is critically important. And so part of one of the strategies, when I keep saying, do whatever it takes, meet people where they are. So, you know, I'm sure you've heard of outreach teams, you've referenced it. And so before, they were very far and few between, right? You would see a few people and they would go out in crisis or whatnot. And so one of the strategies in Measure H is changing that. So when you talk about people being concerned about walking across the street because of the feces and just some the element that comes along when you have a congregation of folks living on the street, the multidisciplinary outreach teams that personally, for my own organization, I have 45 people every single day on the streets of South LA, Compton, and Linwood. And so we are shifting the dynamic of how people get served. And so the strategy is to take the services to the street. And when you say somebody doesn't want any services, we're able now to, even if you don't want to tell us your name yet, we can meet your basic needs because we have registered nurses on the outreach team. We have mental health clinicians. We have substance use counselors. And so if you don't want to talk to us at all, we don't have these outcomes tying our hands to having to talk to a number of people or get their names. The only outcome is you continue to build rapport with people so that you build trust with them. We mend their wounds, we give them food, and eventually they'll be willing to tell us their name. Eventually they'll be willing to tell us their real name, and then we can hopefully get them some services. And so that's across the county and city. I think we'll have almost 300 outreach workers with those different specialties on the street.
So that takes us to the word bridge. Because that's what you're doing. You're bridging. Now, with the housing, it's bridging from point A to point B,
right.
Point B being something more permanent. With the kind of counseling you're talking about, you're bridging trust. Right. And you're trying to get people to trust you. And the only way to get them to trust you is not to push them.
Right.
You let them do what they want to do, and then they know you're somebody that they can talk to when they see you. You might bring them water. You might bring them things to help have a conversation. And that I understand.
And think about your own example. I mean, these are people who often are coming into contact with law enforcement. These are people who people walk by them every day and don't make any eye contact. Right. They feel invisible. These are people who've had not great experiences with different systems. So that trust and rapport and that bridge and compassion are such a critical ingredient to us tackling this issue.
Yes.
You know, when we talk about trust and rapport, it's interesting to me that when we see people on the exit ramps and the street corners and things like that with the signs and asking for help, there are people who will help. There are people that will not look to the left or the right. They'll just keep their eyes straight. But there are people that will help. I know somebody who makes it a part of their drive to stop by one particular place where one particular man is. He's gotten to know the man. He gives him some food. He gives him something like water. And that way he feels that he's contributing to this man. And over time, they have developed kind of a rapport, kind of a friendship, kind of a trust. I always have thought that for those who want to help people, but they don't want to give money because they're afraid that if you give money, it's going to be turned into drugs or turned into alcohol, that the thing to do is to give them a fast food restaurant gift card.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Give them a gift card to a convenience store. Give them a gift card to, you know, a drugstore, so they can walk in, get a toothbrush, walk in, get a candy bar, walk in and get a hamburger. Right. Is that a good strategy?
Well, I think the important part of the strategy that you talked about, and I've taught my sons this, is to make eye contact, to say hello.
Right.
I always do that. And, you know, I love the gift card idea. But I think what's more important to people that are experiencing homelessness is that having human contact, having someone look you in the eye, and I always say, hello, how are you? I hope you have a great day. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it is, thank you so much, God bless you. And they're our neighbors. I mean, Veronica and I talk about that. These are our neighbors in our neighborhood in, right, Silver Lake, where I live, and they're down on their luck. And I think we've got to dig into our humanity and compassion and help our neighbors.
I think that's what a lot of people think.
Yep.
And so what happens to those that are maybe not as together? What do you do there?
So going back to the strategy to actually provide support. And so, you know, when Elise talks about housing first, that's our motto. So ultimately our goal is to make sure people are safe and meet their basic needs. So even if somebody is not on their meds or something like that, you know, as long as we can reason with and they can comprehend what we are saying, we're still going to continue to move them forward and do whatever we can to help move them forward. And certainly, as I said, there's some folks that it took my employees, and I'm not exaggerating, 40 times before the person would even look at them in the eye. But they took our salads, they took the water. And, you know, we just continue to demonstrate that we are here to support them and meet their basic needs. And or, you know, if it's an emergency, like if somebody is in a psychotic episode or something like that, then of course we engage the appropriate emergency system. But otherwise, you just keep building and you keep working with them. And so the new resources are allowing us to do just that.
So let's call this part of the podcast, There for the Grace of God Go I.
Love that.
Yes.
And let me just ask you, what should we think about ourselves? What should we do to kind of get over some of the things that might be the biases and prejudices that we have about homeless people? Because we probably do.
Right. Yeah, that really speaks to me because, this is a career, obviously, and I'm dedicated, but I'm also a woman of faith, a minister's wife. And so, you know, that statement resonates with me. I think that, you know, some of the things you described, just making a connection with folks goes a long way. But I also think that people really need to understand the people experiencing homelessness, first of all, are people. That's the first step. Some people step over them as if they're an item. They're people. And in many cases, they have deep roots in the community that they're currently experiencing homelessness in. And so they are our neighbors. And we need to think about the fact that there's a human being, woman, adult, a woman, man, or child sleeping on the street in the elements, not being able to shower, not being able to have appropriate hygiene. And so when people really humanize it and personalize the fact that these are people we're talking about, I'm hopeful that they will support the permanent supportive housing developments that are trying to be made. I'm hoping that they will support the bridge housing that the mayor's office is trying to do, because we have to get these folks off the street and they're a part of our neighborhood.
You know, I'll share this story, and then if you have an anecdote you'd like to share, that would be kind of nice. Last year, you know, we started looking at homelessness on Fox 11 News in depth on Sunday mornings as sort of a regular diet.
Right.
Because whether it's every show, every five shows, every two shows, it's important to open the door, peek in, and see what's going on.
Right.
Last year, I found three girls who were homeless, living in Orange County, on the street, going to college.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Now, there's something that just disconnects. You're homeless, you can't put a roof over your head, but you're going to college.
Right.
It was a remarkable story. I mean, you can go to college and not afford a house. I mean, that's totally possible. And there are grants and funds and things to help you get an education if you need that. And these girls are still, as far as I know, continuing that education. And there are stories like that where there are people down on their luck who are, for the grace of God go I, lucky enough to be able to find things to help give them a goal, give them a sense of future, give them something other than sitting around and feeling like, and I hate to put it in these terms, it's sort of like an oh, poor me, because it is an oh, poor me. So I guess, you know, that said a lot to me, that these girls would go to that effort to go to school, and they get up from the street, they go to class, they come back, they do their homework on the sidewalk, they ended up in a shelter. You know, it's a tough life.
It is a tough life. And I think we have to remember that people that are on the streets have been through trauma and violence and all kinds of situations we can't even imagine, because they obviously have lost touch with their families or a network that can bring
them
up.
Or even a touch with reality.
Right.
They've lost touch.
Right. Sometimes. But we can't give up on them. And I would say this, I've, you know, been working on this issue for over a decade, and the people I've met who've come in off the streets and into housing, and we're talking how people who've been on the streets for 20 and 30 years,
right.
People that you described, like in front of a Salvation Army wall for 20 years, they are the most gracious, grateful, optimistic people I've ever met.
Resilient.
And they can, it is possible. And I think that's what we need your listeners to know. And I think to emphasize there, but the grace of God go I, is get involved. We are trying to do that through a campaign called everyoneinla.org. And your listeners, we would love to have them be a part of it. But we now, when people move into housing, we do these welcome home parties and welcome home kits. And just the sheer joy and how grown men are weeping,
right,
because they now are home and housed and have a second chance. I mean, to me, that's what our country's based on, is second chances. So my plea to your listeners is don't give up, because we can truly transform people's lives one person at a time.
One person at a time. It's a great concept. It's a great concept in helping people. And, you know, even for me as a reporter, when I'm out on the street and I'm talking to people, I do that one person at a time. And I hear their stories one story at a time. Thanks for listening. And take a moment to subscribe on iTunes, on Google Play, and leave some feedback. Give us a few stars. Have a great day. See you later.